powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
This is Jake and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
We just did Bold Take Friday, and I'm going to keep looking at some of these and bring them back into the show. But I said as part of my bold take, oh, DJ Reed, I'm going to predict the cornerback gets his first interception for Seattle, first cornerback interception. So he'll get his first, and then Quandre Diggs gets his third on the season. I predicted two interceptions. As Curtis pointed out, hasn't happened since against Washington in 2020. And I said, this isn't unique to Roethlisberger, but I said, yeah, Roethlisberger's a guy that, like, when you get some pressure on him and you start hitting him, like, he really makes mistakes with his passing, or with his passing, clearly. And when you force him to pass a ton, he'll make mistakes. Someone texts in, sounds like the kind of quarterback that tears the Seahawks up every year. Every single year, there is a game that we preview and we go, guys, they're playing Colt McCoy. What's the worst that can happen? And then the following Monday, we're going, guys.
Oh, that was the worst that could happen.
We saw it. Colt McCoy. He's great. He can be great.
Nick Mullins.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Nick Mullins. I mean, it's Nick Mullins. What's going to happen following Monday? Nick Mullins was a standout in college. And you really got to watch out for that arm. He's got a cannon.
What a great story he was. I mean, goodness.
All right, but we are talking about the Seahawks defense right now, staying on that theme. Bobby Wagner, speaking with reporters earlier this week, was asked about the struggles, had this to say.
This is a copycat league, and so when you put something on tape and when you have something attack you, teams will mimic that, whether it's the exact same play or they do it in a different formation, a different look, different personnel, and they try to do it. And so it's on us as players to get that corrected. You know, like I said, there's been stuff that we've done over the years that have shown up on tape, and it took us a second to correct it. But once it was corrected, we stopped seeing that show up in games because we fixed the problem. But until we fix the problem, then I don't see it leaving.
So he's saying offenses will keep doing the same stuff to us until we fix it. We saw this last year. They were throwing all over us, and there's more to this, but with certain plays and stuff, and they were doing this over and over and over again because we were allowing it. And when you're an offensive coordinator and when you're a head coach and you're watching that tape from another opponent that your upcoming opponent faced, and you see it work over and over, you think, why not? Let's do it. And Bobby's saying, look, we saw that last year. Finally, we made some changes, and then it stopped. And then they had to beat us in different ways because we started recognizing it. So he says, I know what they're doing this year. We haven't fixed it yet. That's why they keep doing it over and over and over. So I wanted to break down this language a little bit because I think in football, we tend to kind of talk around things sometimes and say, oh, you have some of the same plays that you see. But what is the defense actually seeing? So what are, when Bobby says they're doing the same stuff, what is that stuff that offenses are doing?
Well, if you recognize it first and foremost, like, then fix it, right? Fix it. This isn't the first week that this has happened, right? And so it's just, why is it taking this long to fix it? If you know the issues, if they're easy fixes, if they're easy mistakes, then how come is it's not being fixed and it isn't being immediately addressed? And Pete Carroll talked about this, and this rings true, very, very true in the NFL. It's about how great of fixers can you be? How great of problem solvers can you be? Not just week to week, but in the game as well. So that's something that they have not been very good at the past 2 years, and we'll see if they can eventually get it done. But those things that we're talking about, those things that you're asking and that everybody else wants
really
to know,
it.
Is number one, it's underneath coverage is a mess. So when you have hook to curl in the middle of the defense, the underneath area of the field, it's a mess in terms of understanding the responsibilities that you have and knowing what offenses want to do to you. They always are going to try to create two-on-ones, okay, if you can visualize that in basketball. Now, the way that you want to create two-on-ones offensively is typically you want to give them some cheese, some distraction, something in front of their eyes to get them to come up to that so that you can get the deeper route behind them, right? So that's ideally, in a lot of offensive play calls, you're going to have different levels to your play so that you can try to get the deeper shot and eventually work yourself back down, work yourself top down. And so right now, what these linebackers and what these underneath defenders are doing, whether it's a safety, whether it's the nickel defender and Ugo Amadi or Marquise Blair, is they're being too aggressive in jumping the short routes in front of them, allowing the deeper route behind them get open. Okay, so that's number one. So what they have to do to fix that is they have to stay disciplined. They have to stay deep into their drop. They have to get to about 8 to 12 yards in their depth and stay there and react when the ball is in the air. Okay, I give up the completion, the five-yard completion, and I stop the pass catcher right there in his spot. No yards after catch, okay? That's the responsibility. The second thing is the mid-crosser. So if you can just visualize it in your mind as you're either driving or you're sitting
at your
desk, whatever. Okay, yeah, especially if you're driving.
Please look at
but
the road.
If you have a receiver that starts in the slot to the right and they take a 45-degree angle to the other side of the field around 15 to 20-something yards down the field, there's an area and a void in that cover three zone that teams are trying to exploit. Why? Because the guy that's responsible for that void in the zone is actually Jordan Brooks, or the weak side linebacker has to run all the way down the field with that in their responsibility. And so that's where you see guys like Jordan Brooks really struggle in terms of picking that up, recognizing it, and running to it. That's why KJ Wright, I wouldn't say that in recent years, but for all the years that he was there before his knee injury, that's why he was so dynamic, because he could run with that. He could recognize it and beat the guy to the spot, and he was so darn dynamic in that area.
Now I'm going to have a question here. Jordan Brooks, just generic kind of scouting reports on him, and honestly, first impressions heading into this year was that he'd have a breakout year and that he was really fast and he would be able to make these plays. So is it more of like mental errors that's happening?
Yeah, it's a lot of mental errors. It's a lot. It's a lot of, yeah, no, he's fully physically capable. I mean, he's a special physical specimen that should be a great linebacker in this league. He has all the makings of it. It's recognition. It's being able to recognize, react, and anticipate. The other thing is anticipating, fully understanding how they want to attack you and how they present it and what they're going to do. So that's what KJ Wright has been so good at for years and years and years. Yes.
I literally am raising my hand. Second question. If anyone wants to go back and watch tape, is there an example of, I think I know the answer, a touchdown or a big gain where you saw this play out?
Well, go to the Cooper Kupp pass that Matthew Stafford ended up underthrowing. Do you remember that? And he had to slide down and make the catch. If he catches it, it's a touchdown. Well, that play is between Quandre Diggs and Jordan Brooks. Quandre Diggs needs to recognize that the deep crosser is coming and that's going to cross his face, and he's responsible for that in that moment. And then also Jordan Brooks has to know that he's got to get deeper in his void in that deep third, because they've been attacking that area of the field all night long. So those two guys, that would be a perfect example of the Rams going to that void in that defense and attacking it and completing it. So that would be one that I would go to if you're trying to watch it or rewatch it or understand what exactly I'm talking about. The other things is just having guys in man-to-man situations that teams are really trying to create and maximize. And the two guys that I would point to right now is Sidney Jones and Jamal Adams. Until Jamal Adams can show on a consistent basis that he's not going to give up touchdowns like the one to Tyler Higbee, then they're going to continue to try and test him. They're going to continue to try and see if he can hold up in those situations. That hasn't been the full story for Jamal Adams this season. I think a lot of people are attacking him in coverage in a way that isn't necessarily fair.
You mean critics?
Yes.
Okay.
To me, he gave up two horrific plays in the Rams game that he fully deserves to wear that, but it does not mean that overall as a whole he's been a really bad player in coverage this season. That's not the case. So he has to show that he can win those one-on-one matchups. And then the last thing, it kind of ties back in with the first one, is the 12 to 15-yard dig route in the middle of the field is an area that they just, that route, the seam ball, they've just really struggled in that 12 to 15-yard area of the zone. They just have not done a good enough job recognizing, reacting, and making it difficult on the quarterback to really try to throw it or have to throw it into tight windows.
So how do you fix that?
It,
I know that there are very
if I had the answers, if I had the answers, I'd be getting paid a lot of money to fix that. Okay, but really, it comes down to communication. It comes down to recognition. It comes down to being simply assignment sound, and that's why this whole issue is very frustrating. It's not that you'd have a bunch of players that are physically not capable. That's not the case at all. You have a lot of talented guys that should be capable of doing this, but it's the fact that their eyes are wrong. They're not recognizing the route patterns for whatever reason. And then, as I said before, they're being over-aggressive and jumping the short stuff, jumping the bait, instead of staying disciplined in their zone coverages. And if you fix that, you give yourself a better chance.
Quick question. I think one of the conversations, especially after Trey Flowers' comments following, I believe, the game against Minnesota, but certainly the last couple weeks have been, is communication a problem with this defense? Do you find that communication can factor into, or communication issues can factor into these four things: underneath coverage being a mess, mid crossers, bad man-to-man matchups, those 12 to 15 yard dig routes? So those four main things, or is it more like individual assignments are not being fulfilled?
But if I give you all of that,
yeah.
The other part of it that we're not talking about is the fact that you've had little to no pass rush. So you can fix a lot of those things, but if the quarterback has all day to throw, they can still find voids in the zone. They still can find completions on the field. I mean, these guys in the secondary aren't going to be perfect. So you can't ask them to solve all of the problems. They can solve some. They can make it harder, but that pass rush has to come alive as well. And Dave Wyman, you know, yesterday on the huddle was talking about if the secondary guys can be better in those areas, it will help the pass rush. And I think it's a working relationship together that they have not been able to establish, where the pass rush helps the secondary and the secondary helps the pass rush. Right now, they are in a mess of a situation that way, and they need more contribution from guys, not just Darrell Taylor, Alton Robinson, Carlos Dunlap, Benson Mayoa, Rasheem Green. Where the heck has he been over the course of this time? Puna Ford, you've wanted more from him as a pass rusher. You have not gotten it. That group up front has to be better, and that's why I've been a big advocate of, hey, you got to send Jamal Adams more than you are. You've got to get him more involved in that pass rush, because he might be, next to Darrell Taylor, your most dynamic pass rusher that you have.
We have a four-down territory coming up. Very X's and O's kind of 20-minute segment here, which I love. I am going to squeeze in this very quick question, Curtis. It'll be very, very fast. Just from a texter, Jake, I already think I know what your answer will be, and I know what mine would be. But I'm going to ask it because I think it's one that's probably common after listening to you talk about this. Hey, Jake, from the 253, what about playing just more man-to-man coverage since our zone coverage is poor, or presumably it's struggling? Do we have the personnel for that?
No, we do not. You need great corner play to be able to make that happen. And right now you have a serious, you know, weak link at one of your corner spots. I think DJ Reed can play man-to-man coverage. I think that he could be just fine in that area. Not perfect, but I do think that you could feel comfortable putting him in that spot. But Sidney Jones, Bless Austin, Trey Brown, your rookie, I don't think you can expose them often like that during a game. Can you pick your spots? Absolutely. And they should be able to handle that, but you don't want to play a high percentage of man-to-man when you have some of those weaker areas on the field.
All right, now it's time for Four Down Territory.
This is Four Down Territory, brought to you by Genuine Auto Glass. Going inside the game with quarterback guru Jake Heaps.
Jake Heaps played in the NFL, played quarterback, was in the room with him, was in the fire. He's really a guru. He really played the game.
Man, just like Alex Collins will probably be doing this weekend, carrying a lot of the load for this X's and O's stuff, Jake. I love it. This has been a great segment. So continuing with four questions here. First down, DK Metcalf and Chris Carson didn't practice yesterday. Of the two, who are you most concerned about and why?
I'm most concerned about Chris Carson because I believe that DK Metcalf will still end up playing. For today's practice report will be very telling, but I'm anticipating that DK Metcalf will be at least upgraded to limited in practice at the worst. Chris Carson? Yeah, that's a whole entire different story because he's got a serious neck issue, and I believe it's more stinger-related than anything else. I don't think it's muscular from just the conversation that I'm, you know, parsing here with Pete Carroll. And if that is the case, and they can't get that nerve to calm down and settle down as a running back that runs as tough as Chris Carson, that's a really difficult thing to overcome. And I'm not just worried about it for this week and this Sunday night game. I'm worried about how it's going to affect him for the rest of the season. What is his availability going to look like the rest of the season? That is a serious issue and something that we're not going to get the full detailed answers on, obviously, but something to definitely keep an eye on. And it's just a bummer because this team needs Chris Carson out there on Sunday to have the absolute best chance of winning. It becomes extremely difficult if number 32 is not in the backfield.
Second down. How can the Seahawks pass rush come alive this weekend, and do you think they will?
The pass rush, how it comes alive, is you get Jamal Adams involved more. It's just as simple as that. You got to give the guy more opportunities. You got to give him more chances. He was your leading sack getter last year at 9.5 sacks. He didn't just beat the NFL record in terms of most sacks by a DB. He was the leading sack getter for this Seattle Seahawks team. And yes, they came alive in the second half. And yes, it also happened when Carlos Dunlap was here. But it also happened when Jamal Adams got back into the lineup and healthy. So you want to use your weapons and allow them to do what they do best. And I believe that's for Jamal Adams. That's being around the line of scrimmage. That's getting tackles for loss. That's getting sacks overall. And allowing the rest of the group to get one-on-one matchups. Daryl Taylor, Carlos Dunlap, Kerry Hyder Jr., Benson Mayoa. If more people have to pay attention and worry about Jamal Adams, then it gives better opportunities for the rest of the defensive line to capitalize on those one-on-ones. And if they can do that, I think the pass rush becomes more active in this game and affects Ben Roethlisberger.
Third down. All right, we mentioned Zach Ertz being acquired via trade by the Cardinals. So here's the question about it. Will Zach Ertz be more effective with Kyler Murray and the Cardinals than in his final years with the Eagles?
Yeah, I do. I really believe that Zach Ertz is going to be very effective for the Arizona Cardinals. And you just look at what they're doing. They're 5-0 right now. They see their window of opportunity here with the NFC West and also in the NFC landscape. And I like what they've been able to do. There were a lot of question marks about additions like A.J. Green and J.J. Watt. But it has worked out for them. They've gotten good production out of those guys to complement the young core that they have in Arizona right now. And this is very reminiscent for me. It's hard to watch because it's very reminiscent to me of the Seattle Seahawks during their Super Bowl runs, during their heyday in the Pete Carroll, John Schneider era, where they are a very good team. They're a team that has a high ceiling, and they're continuing to look to add to their roster as they're gearing up to not just try to win the NFC West, but as they're really trying to make a push for the Super Bowl.
Fourth down. All right, we talked about some nice opportunities for the pass rush to finally get going against this Steelers offensive line. Let's look at the negative, and I don't mean to end glass half empty, but what matchups do you not like heading into this weekend?
The matchups that I am the most concerned about heading into this weekend is T.J. Watt and Melvin Ingram against our offensive tackles. Yeah, Dwayne Brown and Brandon Shell. If they cannot establish, if the Seahawks offense can't establish a solid running game Sunday night, you're going to ask those guys to consistently have to stop two pass rushers that are really, really good. And they are going to win. They're going to win more battles than they lose. That's just who those guys are. So that is going to be a matchup that I hope is very limited. If you limit T.J. Watt and Melvin Ingram's chances to rush the passer, you're in great shape. If you have to pass the ball a lot, man, that becomes a really, really hard ask for the Seattle Seahawks. Now, the other aspect of it is Chase Claypool and Deontay Johnson. Those are two very underrated receivers in the league right now. And I am worried about that matchup against Sidney Jones or whoever they put out there at the opposite corner against DJ Reed. You can bet that the Pittsburgh Steelers and Ben Roethlisberger, Matt Canada, the offensive coordinator for the Steelers, are going to try to find ways to take their shots in one-on-one situations against whoever is opposite of DJ Reed.
Who in the Steelers secondary, you mentioned it yesterday, but I want to get back to it. Again, I mentioned that ESPN Steelers reporter Brooke Pryor said, look, the Steelers secondary has not been like a shutdown secondary this year. They've allowed explosive plays at times, and it's been one of the weaknesses of this team. So who is maybe a more favorable matchup for Seattle there?
Well, you're hoping that number 20, Cameron Sutton, is still dealing with injury and that you see a lot of number 42, James Pierre, out there at corner. That's the guy that I would target, that I would circle. The other thing is that Joe Haden is a good player. He's a very good corner, but he's an older veteran. He's not the Joe Haden of old where he was the true shutdown corner in this league. And so if DK Metcalf is out there on the field, I truly believe that DK can absolutely get the better of Joe Haden out there. So, but overall, this is a good group. They've got Minkah Fitzpatrick. They've got Devin Bush, who's playing really well, still on his rookie deal. They've got a guy in Joe Schobert who's a very number 93. He is a veteran in this league that knows exactly who he is and understands his role in coverage. So I think that this group is better than what they're given credit for defensively, because they went up against Josh Allen. They went up against the Raiders, who were rolling at the time. They went up against the Cincinnati Bengals, who has been a surprise story this year, and then Aaron Rodgers of the Green Bay Packers. So it's not like they haven't been going up against good offenses up to this point of the season.
We went through bold takes about 20 minutes ago, 25 minutes ago. This texter, Jake, from the 425 says, Jake's take is as bold as a warm cup of tea.
That's
like
one. That's one man's opinion. One man's opinion, and I highly, very much so disagree.
I don't know.
I do.
It could already happen. Someone said, apologize if you guys have already spoken about it, but what are your thoughts on Ertz going to the Cardinals? Well, Texter, Jake did just talk about it, and when the podcast is up later today, you can check it out in Four Down Territory. Also, we've got a little bit of it in the open as well. We'll probably get back to it a bit later, so don't worry.
Stacey, where can they listen to our podcast?
Oh, yeah. Anywhere you download your podcasts. iTunes, Spotify.
710sports.com.
710sports.com, where you can, if you aren't someone that downloads podcasts, you can also just listen, like click play online and just stream it.
Yeah.
And you don't have to download it.
Download the 710 ESPN Seattle app. You could do that as well.
Also, if you download the podcast or subscribe to the podcast, which you should on iTunes or Spotify, maybe you could leave a review. You know what I mean? Maybe you could leave a comment.
It'd be greatly appreciated.
Five stars only.
It would help us out a lot.
Five stars only. All right. Coming up in the timeline, a controversial call and a very weird description. I think we got a new Jake-ism. It's all coming up next.
This is The Timeline
with Jake and Stacey.
Brought to you by 1-800-DUIOA.
It is The Timeline, reading you the top stories you're going to see on your own timeline. And who can get away from Wilmer Flores trending last night thanks to a controversial strike three call that ended the Giants' attempts at a comeback against the Dodgers. Now the Dodgers have clinched a spot in the NLCS, facing off against the Braves. This was the call itself.
Two strikes. And Flores, did he go?
He did! And the game ends!
Boy, what a way to end the game.
That's bad.
I don't think he went.
That's bad.
Can't end the game that way.
Now, outside of L.A., I think the sentiment was that overwhelmingly he didn't go, and that it was a bad call. There's been a couple quotes to come out from it since. One of my favorites, and there's no way it's real. But it's from a Giants beat reporter for KNBR. So it must be. I have to look into it. He has screenshots of the press conference after things like this. Obviously, they interviewed the first base ump and the home plate ump and have them explain everything. So he said, umpire Ted Barrett on if the crew had different feelings about the Flores check swing call after reviewing the play. Quote, yeah, no, we, yeah, yeah, he... Gabe Morales, the first bait ump, doesn't want to say.
Smooth.
So
nice.
He also is asked, so this is the first base ump responding. He's asked, do you still feel the same way? You know, your call. He says, check swings are one of the hardest calls we have. I don't have the benefit of multiple camera angles when I'm watching it live. When it happened live, I thought he went, so that's why I called it a swing. To me, he clearly knows in hindsight that it was wrong. And it's just such a bummer because even if you can say, well, maybe the Giants don't get that one. It doesn't matter. There's still a chance for them. And I hate that what's been a really good series, but more importantly, what's been a great season for both these teams and a shockingly, kind of just surprisingly great season for the Giants, ended like this. I feel like everyone got cheated.
Well, this is the second series now that has been significantly altered by a ruling or an umpire call. You had the Red Sox Rays with that ground rule double call that the Rays would have possibly won had that gone their way. Now you've got this one where, let's say Wilmer Flores doesn't strike out on that pitch. Who's to say he doesn't strike out on the next pitch? What if he hits a home run? Like, that's what you steal from the Giants in this instance. And frankly, like, if you're going to do instant replay in baseball, why not make swings reviewable in that way? Because you can see whether or not it's a swing from the over-the-top camera.
Right.
TBS had plenty of cameras on that swing. Leaving it up to the first base umpire's discretion is, you're running the risk of what happened last night.
Yes, you are. And also, the fact is that when you talk about that check swing, that's about as obvious of a check swing, a non-check swing, as I've ever seen. Like, did I mess that one up?
We know what you're saying.
It was a check swing for sure, and you're looking at that, and he held back, and the replay should easily refute that, right? You get into a situation where you're looking at check swings, and you're like, I don't know, man. It could really get into a gray area, and you're taking up a bunch of time, and it could go either way. This is why, Curtis, to your point, you would have that as a replay option. Because you'd look at that for 2 seconds and you'd be like, oh, yeah, okay, we're good. We don't need to look at this any further. But it just, I mean, you're talking about ending a run for the Giants that was so historically fun that this is how they lose. This is how they go out, a team that was not expected to be there, almost very much similarly to the Mariners. They were not expected to be in this situation. They end up winning 107 games in arguably the toughest, most talented division in baseball, and then they lose this way? It's terrible.
The odds for the Giants preseason were pretty ridiculous. I heard somebody say that initially the Giants were 85-1 to win the NL West, and they weren't getting any takers on that, so they bumped them down to 100-1.
No.
And then they were getting more takers, and they actually did win the NL West. Like, they were extreme long shots this year, and still managed to put together one of the best seasons in franchise history. And like you said, Jake, it just absolutely stinks to see it end the way it did.
Is Kapler, who's a NL manager of the year to you?
It's got to be Kapler? Dave Kapler, yeah, the Giants manager.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm trying to think of who else it could possibly be.
I mean, the are Red Sox, NL?
Cora, I mean, no, that's AL, never mind. Who was I thinking of?
In the American League?
No, National League.
Well, you've got Dave Roberts with the Dodgers. You've got Brian Snicker with the Braves.
It has to be Kapler.
Yeah.
And it'll probably be Cora in the ALCS.
It could have been.
I know LaRusso was a favorite.
It could have been the Cardinals manager, but he got fired yesterday. Mike Schilt, the guy who won 17 straight to end the season and still got fired.
That's insane. That is insane in terms of how cutthroat sports can be. Jeez. But in terms of the AL, the guy that I think a lot of people still point to is the skipper for the Rays still. I mean, even though they lost in the playoffs, I mean, for them to come back and win over 100 games, for them to win the way that they did this last year with a bunch of guys ended up, moving on, was still very, very impressive. But I would still make a strong case and advocate for Scott Servais as AL Manager of the Year with everything that he did this season, everything that they overcame.
Next story here, some mic'd up moments from Ravens DC Wink Martindale. Now, I have to backtrack. We all know what Jake-isms are, right? We all know.
So, it's where an idiom comes close to sounding like something it might be,
but it's
a little off.
So Jake, sometimes when he uses idioms or tries to describe something, one word will be off and you get what he's saying, but it's not quite right. For instance,
thank you,
that's it in an eggshell, or instead of
lean
a nutshell,
your hat on.
Something you can really lean your hat on instead of hang your hat on. Another one could be, he's instead of jack of all aces. That's another one.
He's the cowbell.
Instead of the bell cow of the offense, Chris Carson is the cowbell of the offense. So it's just one or two things are just switched, and you know what he's saying. But my favorite was a fake one someone texted in when they were like, it's not going to cost you a farm and a leg. I loved that one. Also, Jake had, it's like pulling magic from a hat.
Yeah. Oh, you know what? I'm on a roll. Just go with it.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, Wink Martindale had his own Jake-ism when describing Justin Herbert here.
I think he's one of those guys who could throw a strawberry through a battleship. You know, I mean, he's got tremendous arm talent, accuracy, He is the prototypical NFL quarterback, if you will, in looking at him.
Throw a strawberry through a battleship. Jake, what does that mean?
I don't know. But if I'm going to interpret this, a strawberry is a very soft thing.
Right?
And when you throw it up against a wall or something, it splatters.
That's not what happens.
Battleship's very tough.
Yeah, it is very tough.
Oh, so he's got a lot of arm strength.
Yes. He is so strong that he could throw a strawberry through a battleship.
Oh,
he could sink a battleship with the strawberry.
We knew it would take Jake to explain it to us because I was having so much trouble with that all morning
long. I was thinking it was maybe like the tiny little circle windows on a battleship that he's so accurate he can throw a strawberry.
No, he's not talking about accuracy. He's talking about arm strength.
It is wild that Jake just actually translated that for us.
That really is.
I wasn't expecting that.
Is it weird or does it make a lot of sense?
It makes both of them. Yeah. It makes a lot of sense. We were anticipating just making fun of you, but now look at us. We're the fools because
we
understand something that we didn't understand before.
I didn't realize I had this connection with Wink Martindale, but now I feel very connected to him, and I'm rooting for his defense to be the greatest defense of all time.
All right, that is it for the timeline. Let me fit in a quick IRG injury report here brought to you by IRG Physical and Hand Therapy. DK Metcalf with a foot injury and Chris Carson with a neck injury were listed as non-participants for Thursday's practice. Pete Carroll on the Pete Carroll Preview, Cairo Radio's Friday Preview show, had this update about Carson.
You know, Chris, we'll see at the end of the week, see what the situation is with him. He's much improved, but yet still not cleared. You know, he's not cleared to get back yet. I'm really fired up about Rashad Penny coming back next week. He'll be back next week, cleared to come. He's ready to go right now, and he's one more week on IR to get there. So we'll build that back up. The other fellas are doing good and ready to play.
The important part of that quote, obviously the first part where he says Carson is better, but still not cleared. Pete Carroll is going to be speaking with reporters around 2 p.m. today. It'll be after our show during Wyman and Bob, so I'm sure Wyman and Bob will have some updates whether or not Chris Carson is listed on the injury report, the final injury report. The injury report for the game should come out during our show, so as soon as we see that, we will let you guys know. Switching gears here, the Kraken got their first win in franchise history. The latest from head coach Dave Hackstall. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
This hour of Jake and Stacey is brought to you by Muckleshoot Casino. From having their opener spoiled to playing spoiler themselves, the Kraken got their first victory last night with a 4-3 win over the Nashville Predators, who were playing their season opener at Bridgestone Arena. It was a much better game defensively. Their first two goals both coming on power plays in the first period. Obviously more to come after that, finished with four total, but a fantastic first period. They outshot the Predators. They were much better on defense. They were physical. Everything looked good. Before I jump to these quotes, your first reaction, Jake?
My first reaction was it was great to see them play their style of game first and foremost. And then the other thing was that when it got down to it into the third period, my heart was racing. I mean, I know that that's not the strategy that they want to play every time, and they kind of said themselves that, hey, we got into a mode that, look, we really wanted to get that first win, and we kind of played very conservatively in the third period. But my goodness, Philip Grubauer, all the conversation, if anybody was curious or wondering, oh, you know, you gave up three goals. That third period, he was flat out incredible.
Also, that final.
He was incredible. He had 12 saves in the third period alone, Stacey. It was insane.
That final goal was at 19:20 in the third period. So it was like literally at the close of the game. In my mind, it was.
It was your what?
It counts, but I didn't care about it.
You didn't care about it?
Horrible. It's horrible. Look, I know that goaltending was a featured strength of this team. It was going to be a defensive team. They were going to be physical, and they were going to forecheck, and they were going to have great goaltending. I think you saw that in this one. I know that they allowed three, but I thought it was a phenomenal performance for that first win. Here's what Dave Hackstall said.
Yeah, absolutely it does. You know, and I think you saw a little bit of that stress in us, you know, and in our play in the third period. You know, guys were calm, guys were, you know, pretty focused, and I know guys were really excited to be able to get the first win, and, you know, especially, you know, as it sinks in, it's the first win in franchise history. That's a big deal for everybody.
Now, through two periods, it was 3-2 Kraken. Kraken outshot the Preds in the first period. Predators caught up with them a bit in the second, but you had Alex Wenberg with a goal there at 9:54 in the second. Went really sent it over the top and gave the Kraken a nice lead, a 4-2 lead that they wouldn't surrender until much later. Brandon Tenev with his second goal on the day, an assist from Appleton and McCann on that one.
Yeah, it was nice to get that cheapy right there at the end. But you know, when you talk about the game overall, man, I could definitely see what Buchogras was talking about in the Vegas game, where he's like, "Man, this game is just not as physical as I thought it was going to be." You're like, mm-hmm. "Oh, well, I mean, okay, being somebody that hasn't intently watched hockey,
you're like, looks physical to me."
Yeah, I mean, okay, and then you get in this Predators game, you're like, "Oh, okay, like this is right. What we were talking about. This is the type of physicality that you want to see, and the statements that they are making out there on the ice, and done getting into a scrap, and all these different things. It was so much fun, and it turned up the intensity when it came to, you know, the game as a whole throughout, you know, the three periods of play. So, like I said before, the third period wasn't one that I necessarily loved because I was on the edge of my seat because, the Predators had it, in goal pretty much the entire period. So you would love to see the Kraken be able to balance that out a little bit more, but shout out to Grubauer, shout out to the defense for holding off and for being able to survive through that final third period and come up with the first win in franchise history. That's awesome.
Roman Josi tied it up on a power play in the second period, but it was Alex Wenberg who got ahead. Dave Hakstol talked about how he really liked what they did in the second period. Speaking of that fight, that Vince Dunn fight, he mentions that here too.
You know, Dunner gets in a great scrap, big hit, great scrap. You know, that ends up turning the game for us. You know, our power play did a great job in that sense. We earned that power play. The power play's there. The PP did a very good job pushing us in the right direction. And I just thought, you know, in the second period, I thought we did a better job. I thought we won the line change game during the second period, especially in the second half of that period. We were able to hold the puck, get good line changes, and I thought we had a little bit better energy, and that led to time of possession.
That, I obviously when you're talking about the time of possession, I think that part of it was really the whole story of the game when it came down to the final part of it, and can you survive, can you last, and also, like I said before, can Grubauer hold on? I mean, that guy was tested, tried, everything that you could throw out there in that final period. But, I think that what you're seeing here and what I really like as well is that, you know, part of this and what we talked about, was it with Buchogras or was it with Linda Cohn? It was the idea that, hey, there are some guys that may not have been big-time scores for other teams, but they're going to get the shot with the Kraken.
I think that was Buchogras.
Yeah, I think it was too. And talking about, you know, getting their opportunity and making the most of it. And that's really what you're seeing so far with this group. And can that, from an offensive standpoint, can they continue to be opportunistic when they get their opportunities, when they get their shots? And so far, that has been the case, even in the loss to the Knights. So it was great to see them being on a winning end of this thing, but it was very impressed from that standpoint. And how about our guy, Alex Barré-Boulet?
Barré-Boulet.
Yeah, I don't know how to pronounce it. We'll get there. We'll get there. Him coming into the team legitimately a day before the game, and getting a lot of time on the ice
with
and
an assist for Wenberg's goal.
Yes, yes.
You also had one of my favorite things in the world. Empty net goal. It was Brandon Tanev second.
A handoff for Appleton. Empty net. Just wide off a stick. McCann in front. Bullseye! It's Brandon Tanev with his second of the game. And Seattle has a two-goal lead.
And then you have your captain, Mark Giordano, talking in the locker room afterward.
I think, boys, this should go on the wall at our rink somewhere. First one ever. We all can look at it every day. We'll get something else for the hero of the game. I'm thinking Pirates of the Caribbean, combat, suiting for our team. But Dunner gets my player of the game.
All right, so got to put the game puck somewhere on display when you get back to Seattle and finally play that home opener at
Clement
Ledger Arena.
There was a crazy stat, though, from last week's game where the Kraken win 4-3. Dan Morse of SB Nation's Davy Jones's Locker Room, which is their Kraken-centric blog. What a great name for the blog. Yeah. He tweeted this stat. Winning teams with zero third-period non-empty net shots on goal, only the 14th time since 2011 that a team has won that way, the Kraken being the 14th. So that's like one of those stats where like the Seahawks trail in time of possession like 45 minutes to 15, still win, or like they convert zero third downs in the game. Like the Kraken did not generate much offense in the third period, still won, thanks to that empty netter from Brandon Tanev. Just crazy, crazy stuff in that third period.
All right. Switching gears here to talk to Michael Bumpus. He joins us every single Friday to help us preview the upcoming Seahawks game. Don't go anywhere.